Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Robert O'Hara, who is the Washington Post reporter who wrote a recent front page article on the massive choice point data theft. And he's also the author of a new book, No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society, a book that deals with the data revolution and the government's outsourcing of security and intelligence. We'll go to Mexico City then and speak with Dr. John Ackerman about the state of democracy in Mexico and the possibility of the efforts to thwart the rise of a PRD candidate, the front runner for the 06 presidency to succeed Vicente Fox. We'll be talking with John Ackerman about that. We'll also go to the Middle East to speak with Fidel Gait, who is currently Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer in New York. And we'll be talking to Fidel Gait about warnings from OPEC that we'll be soon experiencing never-before-seen oil prices up to $80 a barrel. I'm now speaking with Robert O'Hara, who's a Washington Post reporter, who created the nation's first privacy beat with a recent front page piece on the massive choice point data theft. He's the author of No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society. And this is a book that deals with the data revolution, the government's outsourcing of intelligence and security. Tell me about the privacy beat. You're the first reporter in the nation to carve out that turf.
Well, there were people back in the 60s and 70s that wrote about it, and there was a guy at the Times that wrote a series of enterprise pieces in the 1980s talking about computers. But in the late 90s, I wrote quite a lot about the data revolution and marketing and the extraordinary changes in the ability to collect information about all of us.
And is there any constitutional protection for privacy?
Well, actually, no. I mean, we have obviously the Fourth Amendment, and
The IRS certainly rolls over that one.
Right. There's nothing in the Constitution that explicitly states that. I actually have been trying in recent years to sort of redefine the terms of the discussion about what we used to call privacy. I think it should be more about autonomy and the idea that we have a right to be let alone from institutions and the government meddling with us. And so it's really a big issue about autonomy and how do we make sure that we have the most of it while at the same time understanding that we have to improve security.
But the choice point story that you did the front page article in the Washington Post on really blows that wide open in the extent to which not only are people's privacies invaded, they're transacted, and as it turns out, in a very haphazard and sloppy way.
It's Choice Point is a prime example of a data industry that has grown in extraordinary ways. And to the average person, probably many of the people listening here, there's no way to tell just how quickly the industry has grown. In the last 7 or 8 years, Choice Point has acquired 58 other companies and has collected something like 19 billion records. Those records are about virtually every American in the United States.
And now apparently it's possible or quite likely that the personal information of a lot of listeners out there have been sent to Nigeria or to the Russian mafia.
There's no way to know where the information has gone. There's 145,000 records that they've acknowledged were seeped out to this ring. They only have one suspect. They believe there's many more involved, and the fact is there's no way to know how this was used. It could be anywhere abroad. It could be used to create identities for use in criminal activities, you know, to the extreme. It could be terrorism, or it could just be garden variety nasty fraud where they try to rip you off by charging up things in your name or stripping your bank account. But what it shows us, and this is very important, it's not just the fact that the information is available. It's the fact that it can be used so easily to take on the persona of another person. And that's because the retailers, credit issuers, banks, you name the institution, do not do a good job of authenticating who we are. So there's this sort of wide complicity that includes all of us as well, who take all these conveniences for granted, and in fact we demand them. And so in the name of convenience, they don't authenticate, they don't take the security measures that would make things less convenient, and as a consequence we have this terrible problem that's both a consumer problem and a security and a national security problem.
But specifically, Robert O'Hara, in terms of the choice point theft, a 41-year-old Nigerian national is the only person charged. North Hollywood here, in, not far from the studio, presumably.
They got him on a single count, and so he's going to jail for 16 months. The investigation is really just getting underway, and they have to find the links, not only among all the searches, but trying to trace back to computers and try to trace who owned those computers and use them to make the searches. It's going to be a laborious process, and the FBI, Secret Service, and other agencies are stepping in just at the same time that we're now going to be seeing all sorts of inquiries on the Hill. And what comes of that, you know, you never know. But the thing that everybody should remember the Choice Point identity theft scandal is really the very tip of a massive data revolution, and involves us, many, many different companies from, Choice Point and its competitor LexisNexis, and companies like that most people don't know of, Sizent, Axiom, and then big companies like IBM and the big three credit bureaus. The list goes on and on. And what they are doing, along with your grocery store and the toll booths, the electronic toll booths, your cell phone company, is they're all keeping records in a way that just wasn't possible even 10 or 15 years ago. And so we're creating this giant matrix in which information about us is being collected, routinely collected, and more it's being analyzed and shared and sold, so that we're seeing the emergence of, in effect, a surveillance society infrastructure.
So, in other words, this data, none of which can be cross-checked or verified, they mine it, and whatever they have is what they have.
Well, think of it this way: we're in effect digital comments that leave this long trail of information about us every day in our wake.
You mean what we eat, what we read?
Right, exactly. When we buy a book online, if we cruise the web, if we're looking at porn sites, if we're buying football tickets, when we buy our groceries and use the discount card, the toll booth that you go through, every time you use your debit card or your credit card, your cell phone, the location where you're using your cell phone. My cell phone company is recording to provide the convenience and the efficiency of the cell phone to me. It's recording where I am, all right? And that's something that I want. I want that service. But the byproduct is that it's another data point in the matrix of my life. And as we move forward and these companies, whether they're financial institutions or telecommunications or just simply an information broker, they're just getting better and better at making sense of that information. And in many cases, they're providing things that we want, the direct marketing, the what they call the customer relationship management, but they're also outsourcing selling things to a new customer, which is the federal government and the security industrial sort of complex that is also trying to make us safer.
Now, how does this relate to the John Poindexter story? Remember Poindexter, famous from Iran-Contra, had a job over the Pentagon where he made a proposal to mine all kinds of data in terms of the war on terror.
Well, it turns out I spent a great deal of time with Poindexter for my book, for No Place to Hide, which also for interested people is a documentary that they can get online, and it's pretty fascinating because Poindexter's in it. What we learned is that Poindexter wasn't the inventor of total information awareness That had actually happened a couple years earlier by a friend of his named Brian Sharkey, who's a intelligence specialist who works for a government contractor called SAIC. And after 9/11, the two of them had the same impulse that, you know, many of the rest of the world did, which is, you know, what can we do to protect ourselves going forward, and how can we fight back? It's just the difference with them is that they had, you know, they had access to the Defense Department, and they decided that they were going to create an information awareness office. And as spooky as that sounded, they actually were quite earnest about creating a whole variety of programs that would ultimately tap data systems around the world and then make sense of that data using artificial intelligence and other tools, because Poindexter's thesis was that the human brain wasn't capable. In fact, he was right in this. It's not capable of assimilating all the information. So what he wanted to do was create an automated structure that would constantly watch the world and look for signs of terrorist threat that would enable us to be proactive as opposed to reactive. Now, Poindexter's program, as everybody knows, was shut down when Congress, like many Americans, freaked out about the scale and scope of his ambitions and the program's ambitions. And yet, the same goals are still in place in the intelligence world, the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, and even some private companies are all trying to replicate that notion of watching proactively for signs of, be it a buying opportunity or a terrorist threat. It's the same, conceptually the same kind of thing. The FBI even declared that it was no longer going to be a reactive agency, that it was going to be proactively looking for crimes before they occurred. And I don't think it takes a lot of thought to recognize that that poses some new challenges for us in terms of maintaining a balance in a democratic society.
So this is just an extension of the new Bush doctrine in foreign policy.
Well, it's very right. I mean, it, in some ways, you know, you're right there. They're very open about preemptive warfare,
right,
and being proactive. And I think that, you know, it's not just Poindexter, who is a brilliant guy who's very zealous about his patriotism. And that obviously always, as Brandeis told us, poses problems. We need to be aware of people who are zealous because they sometimes can lead to things that we find unacceptable. But he's not an evil guy. And there's lots of guys out there like that, and men and women who are taking advantage of these information technology tools and billions and billions and billions of records about people abroad as well as people here at home. And they have not thought through all the implications. And we certainly haven't had the national debate that in some ways is beginning because of an identity theft case, but we can only hope that it doesn't stop there, because the identity theft Choice Point scandal is literally it's the pimple on the hide of the elephant. It's only the indication of what's really happened in the last 10 or 15 years.
And that's just Robert O'Hara again, a reporter with the Washington Post, who had a front page article on the Choice Point theft, and he's also the author of No Place to Hide: Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society, a new book that deals with the data revolution of the government's outsourcing of security and intelligence. I'm trying to understand the future. I mean, for example, already in England, there's much, much more surveillance than we have here, because you have the visual surveillance. Every street corner has a camera, and Scotland Yard catch most of their criminals now by literally tracking them on a network of surveillance throughout Great Britain. We haven't gotten there yet. In the wake of 9/11. There's some talk about some kind of a national ID card. It comes up periodically because several of the 9/11 hijackers were pulled over prior to 9/11 by cops, and they had phony ID. So where does this stand with a national ID card? Because, you're talking about Choice Points selling off private data on individuals. Every time you swipe your card, you're likely to lose that information, no matter where this happened.
Here's a couple of things. First of all, the cameras in England are often cited by, first of all, let me say this. People need to recognize that the problem that we confront is infinitely more difficult than it first appears, as difficult as it does appear, because there are so many benefits that we derive from information technology, not just as consumers, so-called, but also for security. I mean, police use this information all the time in investigations, and it really does help them. And there's no disputing that. So how do we balance out the troubling things while maintaining the benefits? Okay, that said, let's look at the ID issue. And this goes to the issue of Great Britain as well. There you have a very different culture that appears more willing to use information technology and surveillance technology in very refined ways without this constant bleeding of mission. Here, if you create a data system in the U.S., it's guaranteed that it will be used for 20 other things or 1,000 other things before you know it. It's a phrase called mission creep. Now, the problem with that is, what do we do once we create the national ID with the thumbprint on it? In an ideal scenario, that could be a fabulous way of preventing identity theft and helping to improve security, although it is no panacea, so don't believe that it's a panacea. But we could do that, and we could use it in a very narrow way and have really tight restrictions, or we could do, as I suppose we almost surely would, which is we'd create the national identity card, have a thumbprint, and that every corporation, every grocery store, every gas station would then use it as a way to collect information about you, and it'd be the most efficient data collection mechanism ever created in the U.S. Suddenly, not only do they have to intuit where you've been from your cell phone car, from your cell phone call or the toll booth or whatever, they would know precisely because you'd be sharing your thumbprint to get in and out of places and getting through toll booths and so on. That's the fundamental problem. Now, I see some sort of de facto national ID is almost a certainty because there's already legislation that would tie together the driver's license bureaus around the DMVs around the country. And while they talk about it being state initiatives, it's actually, if it's a national standard and if they're sharing the information, it's a de facto national ID card. So we should expect that. We should expect more and more surveillance going forward. And they're going to get better and better at making use of the information so that they don't just know where you are, but they can intuit things about you. They can get into your head and make predictions about what you're likely to do based on buying and travel and demographics about you in ways that you may not even know yourself. So we're definitely headed this direction. Many millions of us Americans are going to embrace the conveniences and discounts. There's no question about that. What I want, and as a journalist, this is the only thing that I truly advocate for, which is let's shine a bright light on it and have a true, honest, and open discussion about how to handle this. Otherwise, I see a lot of downside going forward.
Well, I guess the only upside that I see to this, apart from the fact that we have an absurd situation now where we have, you know, porous borders and you've got a kind of an alliance between the laissez-faire right and the politically correct left to do absolutely nothing about border security. But the one thing that I think is that could come out of it, if a national identity card is inevitable, then I hope that politicians tie that into using that as a right for every American to vote. So we take care of that, the fact that the last two elections have been pretty shaky, you know.
Well, you can hope, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of interest against that second part, which I'm not an expert in. But
I know
we can be sure that there's going to be a lot more surveillance, a lot more scrutiny going forward. And if the choice point situation tells us anything, it's that all this information, as it's being collected, is not safe. It's not secure. As much as it's giving you a lot of conveniences and discounts and services that we all take for granted, there's a vulnerability there that very few people have taken the effort to explain to most Americans. And, I say shine the bright light and let's have the discussion.
Well, it's not just about you are who you say you are, which I think is the biggest canard about voting, is that as soon as you try and emancipate people, they say it's fraud. So you can clearly take care of that. But the problem is that not only does it tell you who you are, it tells you all about yourself, right?
Well, the voting issue sounds very compelling. I'm not a real expert,
right.
I can say that in the book, if you don't mind me making reference to it,
no, go ahead.
There's a lot of characters like Poindexter, Viet Dinh, who wrote the Patriot Act for the Justice Department. There's these strange data geniuses who are designing software systems both for corporate America and for the super secret NSA and CIA. Their stories help to show just how phenomenal these changes have been and why we need to pay attention now.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert O'Hara.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, Amy and Masters. I'm just speaking then with Robert O'Hara, who's a Washington Post reporter, whose recent front page article on the massive choice point data theft. The top two officers in the company knew this was coming, and they traded $16 million worth of stock options. The new book he's written is No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society, which is a book about the data revolution and the government's outsourcing of security and intelligence. I'm now speaking with Dr. John Ackerman, who teaches at he's a professor at the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences in Mexico City. And he had a recent article in the New York Times with his father, Bruce Ackerman, Immune to Democracy, about the efforts on the part of both the pre and, I guess, the PAN party, the PAN being the party of the current president, the first non-pre-president in the history of Mexico, at least in modern history, Vicente Fox. And the PRD candidate, who's the mayor of, or the likely candidate, who's the mayor of Mexico City, is, by all polls, most likely to be the at least the guy to beat for the 2006 presidential elections. And they're trying to basically knock him off the ballot on a trumped up legal charge. And the immunity issue gets down to the Congress, right? So where does it stand now? You've got a pre-dominated Congress, which has always actually been the problem with Fox's 6 years, hasn't it? Or not that he's got 5 years in, that he's never really been able to get anything through because the pre dominate the Congress. And I guess he made the choice to be nice to the pre. And there's an expression in this country that nice guys finish last.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hi.
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in your program. It's a pleasure to talk about these issues. The first important thing to clear up about it is that this is really an initiative of the executive, of the Fox government itself. The PRI is, up to this point, still considering whether it's going to vote in favor or against of the removal of the immunity for Andrés Manuel López Obrador. They have not been directly implicated in it yet. That's sort of one of the reasons why we need to put lots of international attention on this issue, because they are sort of consulting among themselves and trying to decide whether they're going to vote for or against. The problem begins and originates in the executive branch with the Fox government itself, particularly the Attorney General or the Procurador General, who is Rafael Macedo de la Concha, who decided almost a year ago to present criminal charges against the mayor of Mexico City on supposed breach of a court order. Right? Contempt of court is the sort of the English translation of what they're accusing him of.
Well, it's a very, very prosaic and rather petty issue involving extending a road to a private hospital.
Yes, exactly. The Mexico City government tried to open up a road to a new hospital, the ABC Hospital in the western part of Mexico City. Actually, a foreign-run hospital. I believe it's British and U.S. capital. The Mexican government was trying to open up a road to have access to the hospital, and the property owners protested the expropriation, which was done of a part of their land. What's being contested is not the expropriation itself, but there was a court order that was issued during the process of deciding the protest against the expropriation, which ordered the Mexico City government not to stop construction entirely in the first instance. instance, but only to allow the property owners access to their territory, to their land, right? So they were supposed to remove the large machines and stuff in the access points that was all that was required. Now, supposedly, this wasn't done immediately. It took a few days. We don't know. I haven't seen convincing evidence on either side. I can't take a sort of a stance on the legal details of the issue, but it doesn't seem to me that it's absolutely convincing that they took these extra days. But even if they did take 2 or 3 days or a week to sort of comply with the order, it's still sort of a pretty clear, sort of ridiculous proposal on the part of the executive to try to basically what amounts to an impeachment of the mayor of Mexico City for such a minor offense. This has never happened before in the history of Mexico. This is theoretically, the Attorney General could have done it for various cases. The President Attorney General has had 3 or 4 similar cases before him in the last 2 or 3 years, and over the last couple of decades there have been hundreds and thousands of cases of this, and never in the past has the executive actually proceeded to criminally prosecute or to try to criminally prosecute a sitting member of the government or of any level of government. And there's a very good reason for this. I mean, the immunity exists, as it does in the United States, and so that the law can't be used for political means, right? The law is supposed to be used for criminal means and not to resolve political disputes. And so that's why in the past this hasn't happened. But it seems to be the fact that López Obrador is much of a threat to the executive, to the Fox government, that they've proceeded in this way.
And it's a bit odd, isn't it, that the Fox government would be wanting to stop this PID candidate who's, a front runner in terms of the next race, when the Fox government itself hired so many PID people, including Castaneda and others, you know, foreign minister.
Yeah.
So what's going on there? I mean, also, just if you want to touch on the point I made in the intro, which is that the pre never really went away. They never drove a heart through the stake of the beast like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
And it's always maintained its grip over the Congress and frustrated Fox's tenure as president, and largely resulting in being a major disappointment.
On the first question, in terms of the relationship between the Fox government and the PRD, in the beginning, yes, they did hire some ex-PRD people. Neither Castañeda nor Aguilar Zinzer nor Muñoz Ledo at the moment when they moved into the Fox government, we were not members of the PRD anymore. But he did make a gesture towards the center-left, the sort of social democratic forces in Mexico. But all of these members of Fox cabinet are no longer there. If you notice, Castañeda has renounced those Aguilar Zinzer, and so has the ambassador Muñoz Ledo, who was the ambassador to the European Union for Fox. All three of them have left the Fox government because of a certain disappointment in his commitment, not to leftist principles, but his commitment to state reform, which he had put forth as a major plank of his agenda when he first came into the government. And so really during the 4 or 5 years of the Fox government, he has not made any serious gestures towards the PRD or the sort of social democratic platform of social democratic reform, not even in economic terms, which wouldn't be expected, but in terms of democratic terms, improving human rights, basic sort of accountability issues. López Obrador does represent a threat, and one of the major reasons why he represents a threat is because of his stance, for instance, on the banking scandal of the 1995, 1996, 1997, the big Fobaproa banking scandal, which was similar to the U.S. savings and loan scandal. There were lots of insider lending. There was lots of fraud occurring, which was bailed out unconstitutionally by the Mexican government under the Zedillo government from 1994 to 2000. And now López Obrador, for instance, yesterday has declared that he would, if he were elected president, create a truth commission to evaluate the fraud that existed among the bankers. And so you can imagine, this is billions and billions of dollars, like $60 billion we're talking about. And so you can imagine that the bankers are sort of concerned about this, and this is very closely allied to the PAN. In terms of the pre, there is a risk here that if the PAN, in its fear that López Obrador would become president, kicks him out, there is a fear that even more dangerous forces for them could actually come to power. The pre has by no means disappeared off the political map. They continue to be very strong. They lost in the most recent governor's election in Guerrero, which was a definite change after decades of cacique rule. But in other state governments, for instance, in Oaxaca and Veracruz, the PRI has still managed to hang on, and they still do dominate the Congress. They have the largest group in the House of Representatives, the Chamber of Deputies, and they have the majority in the Senate. They do continue to control. So if this were to go forward, it would be problematic for democracy in general, because it's sort of being unloyal to the principles that democracy is about, people facing themselves in the polls and not through the use of or the abuse of law. But it would be additionally dangerous because of the risk that the PRI would come back to power. I think that's definitely a second sort of factor involved in this process.
Uh-huh. Well, the specter of the PRI coming back into power was mentioned by Senator Barbara Boxer in the confirmation here. Hearings for Condoleezza Rice.
Right.
There was no response from Condoleezza Rice about the Senator Boxer's concern that the PRI came back to power, but she was clearly implying that that it would be bad for everybody. And so Condoleezza Rice will be in Mexico City next week. Just though, to finish up on this, John Ackerman, why didn't Fox go after the PRI to really do an accounting like they did in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? I mean, they did it in a very half-hearted way. Echeverria, who's the kind of the godfather of all the dinosaurs, may well have been behind the assassination of Colosio. He's sort of half on trial. They never really did an accounting of the dirty years. They never even did an accounting of the flagrant theft of the 1988 elections, which brought Salinas to power. Clearly, the PRD Cardenas won that election by all accounts. So there's a lot. In other words, the PRI wouldn't be quite the threat that it is to Mexican democracy if there would have been an accounting of the 70-year rule of this metastasized, corrupt organization.
Mm-hmm. I think you're very correct to point this out. This is a big issue in terms of Mexican democratic tradition. We haven't really had a major moment of transition in sort of the purest form of the word of the departure of one group of people controlling power and the entrance of another group and a sort of taking account with the past. It's been a lot more of a sort of a smooth transition. The Fox government worked very closely with Zedillo in the transition, and after Fox came in, you're correct, he didn't make any attempt, well, he has very little attempt to create any kind of truth commissions. There's been talk about it. Aguilar Cinzer was going to be in charge of this, but he, as we know, is no longer in the government, and it did not happen. And basically, the reason for this is that the PAN needed and continues to need the large sectors of the PRI in order to pass its economic reforms. It still hasn't been able to do so, but its bet was that by appeasing with the PRI, they would be able to earn PRI votes in the Chamber of Deputies and the Senate, which, as you mentioned, are still very powerful in the Congress, in order to pass significant reforms like the privatization of the National Oil Company, like the privatization of the electrical companies, the increase of value-added tax, flexibilization of labor reforms. These are all sort of basic economic agendas which are on the plate of the PAN and which are shared with large sectors of the PRI. But in order to get these through with the PRI support, they needed to assure the PRI that they would not take revenge for past occurrences. And so now that Fox hasn't been able to get through the economic reforms either, this is good for some people, bad for others, basically what's turned out is he hasn't been able to achieve much on either side of the coin. And this is a real concern. Yeah, the PRI still continues to be powerful. And what's more worrisome is that the PRI itself hasn't really renovated itself. I mean, the democracy in Mexico is not equivalent to the disappearance of the PRI. If and when the PRI itself decides to restructure itself in a more democratic and honest and accountable manner, but there isn't evidence that that has happened either.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Dr. John Ackerman, who is a professor at the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences in Mexico City, where he's the coordinator of the research program on accountability, legality, and the rule of law. And you mentioned the surprise results in the state of Guerrero, where the PRD candidate won the governorship for breaking decades-long, you mentioned cacique rule, the Figueroa family are pretty much drug gangsters, and there's been a conduit for illegal drugs from Colombia through that state. You know, the PID guy's going to have a hard time because it's, you know, even if you vote these people out, it's like the mafia, you know. They don't go quietly into that good night.
Right. It's a big question what's going to happen in Guerrero. Seferino Torreblanca, who is the new governor of Guerrero, comes in with the PRD. Although he has a support beyond the PRD as well in sort of civil society, he's a businessman himself. So he has a little bit broader support than the typical sort of leftist constituency, which will be important. The other important thing is a sort of an inheritance from the tree rule is that the state legislature and the municipal government elections in Guerrero are held, I believe it's this upcoming August, exactly sort of 5-6 months after the governor elections, which historically has allowed the new governor to place his people in each of the key sort of power holes within the state. Now the opposition government will be able to do the same, so that will be another sort of strength, although it should be reformed eventually. At this point, at least in terms of transition politics, it's important in order to actually consolidate the democratic transition. And it's a big question. I mean, here Seferino Torreblanco, the governor, will need lots of support from the FARC government, and the question there is how much the FARC government itself is committed to supporting the combat against narcotraffic, and whether they're able to put aside ideological differences for the moment and work with the state of Guerrero to do so. Because the state government still don't have a whole lot of budget, and most of the actions in terms of narcotraffic is controlled at the federal level. So there needs to be some close collaboration there, and it's a big question whether Fox is interested in working with Seferino Torreblanca in this and committed to do so.
Well, just in closing, John Ackerman, the clearly 9/11 blew Fox's relationship with Bush away. I mean, the first place that President Bush visited was Mexico, and obviously it was one of the his press conference down there was one of the more disturbing because he's a different guy today. He's improved on the job, in case you haven't noticed. but clearly. Once 9/11 happened, Mexico became orphaned, and Condoleezza Rice, the new Secretary of State, is going down there next week. She's never been a Latin American specialist. She's a specialist in two countries that no longer exist, the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia.
Right.
So
what do
Mexicans the chattering class down there in Mexico City expect from this trip?
I don't think there are really high expectations. The Condoleezza Rice trip down here next week or this upcoming Thursday is preparation for the meeting between Fox and Bush at the end of the month. This will be the first meeting with Bush since his new 4-year term, and migration is definitely on the table. I think people are a little bit skeptical by now because of the sort of roller coaster ride that we went through in the beginning of both the Fox and the Bush administrations. There's definitely some hope that there could be some sort of migratory deal brokered, although there's a real desire that deal be something that goes beyond just a visiting worker program, sort of a rehashing of the Bracero program, because something like that is not going to actually resolve the question of the lack of basic human rights of the migrants in the United States and in Los Angeles and California specifically. The migrant class, even though they might be able to have a work permit, needs to have the full range of human rights in order to develop themselves as full citizens in the United States and in Mexico and construct North America between both of us, which is more just and equal.
Well, it's clearly that's the one part of the immigration discussion that doesn't even rate a mention, and that is that if the economy and conditions in Mexico were better, Mexicans would prefer to live in their own country. Over here in the United States, this Lou Dobbs on CNN is making a sort of theme of the broken border. So it seemed to me that this is an issue that's not going to go away. In fact, it's going to get more and more. And because it is by nature incendiary. You know, we have this peculiar alliance between the laissez-faire right and the politically correct left to make sure that there's no serious discussion. So just in closing, what's your expectation that the relationship between Mexico and the United States will be hung up on this issue, or will they get beyond it?
My expectations aren't particularly high in terms of, as far as I can see from the Bush administration's declarations, that they're not sort of particularly interested in anything beyond sort of a migrant working program or really rethinking. They're not really trying to rethink North America as a unit that is sort of, you know, that in which the border is becoming more of a fiction. They're more interested in closing down borders. And Fox himself has not been sort of really vigorous in defending the interests of the Mexicans in the United States. He's made some important declarations, but not sort of demonstrated his real strong commitment. So I'm not too optimistic about it. I'm hopeful. You know, we have to be optimistic in the long term, but in the short term, it doesn't seem like it's too encouraging, the outlook. I think there needs to be a lot more discussion, debate between sectors in Mexico and the United States about this, and we really need to work together in order to achieve something positive.
Well, presumably we ought to work together to prevent the reemergence of the PRI, because if Mexico is to democratize and the rule of law is to flourish, that's the last thing that will happen if the PRI make a comeback.
Yeah, I think that's one of the major dangers of the whole issue, and I would really encourage people to look up more information on this whole attempt to take the immunity away from the mayor of Mexico City, because it's a real attack on basic principles of democratic politics, and it's something that U.S. can really do something about it. And for instance, just a little fact: USAID is funding, it's a project something on the order of $25 million over 5 years in Mexico on the topic of accountability, transparency, and the rule of law. This isn't sort of really publicly known, but I know it for a fact. And the U.S. is very much involved in democracy in Mexico, but it's a question of really making sure that involvement is a positive one and make sure that there's sort of equal possibilities for anyone who wants to run for president to be able to do so.
I thank you very much for joining us from Mexico City. Dr. John Ackerman.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, Amy and Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. John Ackerman, who's a professor at the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences in Mexico City, where he's the coordinator of the research program on accountability, legality, and the rule of law. I'm now speaking with Fidel Guite, who graduated from Cairo University and New York University. He's currently the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer Funds in New York City. Mr. Guite has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research. He's previously been with Mobil Oil and the J.P. Morgan Company in New York. And just this week, oil prices, and I think everybody who goes to the pump at the gas station knows this in no uncertain manner. We're up to about $55 a barrel, but a more alarming prospect was voiced by OPEC, where it said that we may be seeing in the near future oil prices of $80 a barrel. Fidel?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, what's your what's behind this this warning from OPEC that we'll soon be experiencing never before seen oil prices up to $80 a barrel?
OPEC will let oil prices go as far as they can if we are not signaling any opposition. For the first time, U.S. President never mentioned oil in the State of the Union address since Richard Nixon. Our economy continue to do very well. We have no inflation whatsoever. Our Fed chairman said that oil prices have not really had any negative impact on the economy. So all in all, we are kind of giving OPEC the green light that things are okay. You know, if it's not broken, don't fix it. On the other hand, adjusted for the weak dollar, OPEC is generating today, believe it or not, as much export revenue as they generated 4 years ago when oil prices were in the mid-20s. So all in all, OPEC is not really ripping us off. OPEC is just generating the revenue that will keep their economies moving.
But, of course, since the oil is denominated in dollars, this has been a windfall for the euro countries, right?
Correct.
They're getting cheap oil now.
Correct. The Europeans are basically paying, adjusted for the weak dollar, prices in the low 30s. And so it really has not impacted them negatively at all. As I said, only the USA economy should have been impacted negatively by higher oil prices, but there are no signs that we have still strong demand. People are not giving away their SUVs. We see no signs whatsoever that the demand is cooling off. People are not voicing their anger, if you will, at the gas pumps. So all in all, OPEC is telling us no harm, no foul. You are not complaining. It's not hurting you. So why should we induce a lower oil prices that will hurt us?
So in other words, a 15% rise in the last month hasn't caught the attention of the American motorist. Maybe that's I'd have some questions with that. But if the oil goes from $55 high a barrel to $80, surely that'll get the American motorist attention.
Well, at certain point, I think the elasticity of demand will show that higher prices will have negative impact on the demand, and that will catch the attention of everybody.
So what's driving this spike in oil then?
Well, the same factors that pushed oil prices to $55 in October of last year from January $30 level. Global tension is the same or greater than it was a year ago. Fears of potential supply disruption is the same. Excessive speculation by major financial institutions is still actually going stronger and stronger. Supply is still tight. Demand remains very strong. So the same factors that pushed oil prices last year are also driving oil prices now.
So let me try and get from you, Fidel Guyot, who again is the currently the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research at the Oppenheimer Funds in New York City. What is
It's Oppenheimer and Company, not Oppenheimer Funds. They're two separate companies.
Oh, okay. So Oppenheimer and Company. Okay. So here we have the most oil-friendly president probably the United States has ever had. And on his watch, oil's going up. And you mentioned the fear premium. The fear premium is insecurity on the part of traders about the possibility of a major disruption given tensions in the area with the ongoing Iraq war and Afghan war, turmoil in Lebanon, pressure on Syria, threats against Iran. Does it strike you as an irony that that such an oil-friendly president has been so bad for the price of oil? I mean, isn't it a repudiation if the market's saying we think that at a geopolitical level we're likely to have the United States is likely to precipitate a catastrophic cutoff? That's not isn't the well. I thought the idea was to bring security to the Middle East, not insecurity.
Well, a couple of things. A sharp drop in oil prices, if we theoretically assume that it could happen, could destabilize the governments that are friendly to us, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates. These countries, they need oil export revenue to keep their population happy. They are obviously very unpopular governments. So basically, they are buying stability, if you will, through handouts, if you will. So we need that. We cannot afford any supply disruption. So the signal here to OPEC is that you keep supply lines open, and we are not going to pressure you to bring oil prices lower. We also had a disappointing situation with the Kremlin, with President Putin. Only a year ago or so, we thought that he would open Russia to investment by major oil companies, and it's going to be almost a safety net for the world and all this. That has changed completely, and in the last few weeks, the Kremlin said that major oil field in Russia are going to be considered state treasures, or they are off limits to foreign companies. So this, all in all, we think we saw changes in the geopolitical situation. We're putting pressure on President Putin, and this is his way of getting back to us, because if you're counting on me to bail you out in case that there's supply disruption in the Middle East, so you better be nice to me. And so there is a trading situation here.
I see. So how much of the oil price, current oil price, is the fear premium?
Well, I would say there is at least $15 of the, you know, we have almost $55 oil now. You take it down to $40. The rest is speculation. You know, the kind of like you have to adjust for the weak U.S. dollar. If the U.S. dollar continue to weaken, there is no hope for oil prices to come down anytime soon, because basically we are telling OPEC, we are giving you funny money. We are giving you money that is not going to buy you much, you know, if we continue to deteriorate our currency. Now, if our currency strengthens, I think the excuse for OPEC to generate higher revenue, I think, will be not a factor as it is now.
So why is it that this story continually floats around? I guess perhaps it's just people, it's an urban myth or something. The notion that at some point or other, the OPEC countries are going to be dissatisfied with the United States and start denominating oil in euros. Given that the Europeans are now getting a discount, I can't see the logic of that. Where does that story come from, and why does it persist?
Well, not very likely, because for a couple of things, the Saudi government is probably holding most of our debt, and this is something that it's quid pro quo here. We provide them with military protection to keep the regime that is very unpopular in place, and in exchange, they will guarantee the supply of oil. They would not dare even think, let alone do, take the price of oil from U.S. dollar into euro or any other currency.
And what about the theory that was also offered up recently here, where some people think that the United States is getting played in the Middle East, that the neoconservatives in the Pentagon played us, got us into a war with on false promises and pretenses, and that the Iranians through Chalabi have been playing us because they're going to be the beneficiaries. Certainly, in the short term, it looks like they've got a friendly government that has just been will be elected in Iraq. What about the notion that the Saudis played us too, because as long as Iraq's in turmoil, the second biggest oil supplier in the world is essentially off the market. They've been off the market since, the first Gulf War. So where does that stand? I mean, it seems.
Well, unfortunately, our Middle East policy is very flawed because, for all practical purposes, if we don't have a puppet government in Iraq, it is likely to be a very radical Islamic fundamentalist with more leaning toward the Iranian side, if you will, than any other part of the Middle East. So it is like jumping from the frying pan into the fire. Let's face it, these people harbor no love or respect for the U.S. at all, maybe fear, but nothing else. So therefore, any regime that is friendly to us in the Middle East is perceived by the people in the Middle East as a puppet regime that needs to be getting rid of. So we really cannot even extend helping hand to a democratic opposition to any friendly regime right now, because immediately we will discredit these forces.
So what is there any likelihood? I mean, the neoconservative dream that the Iraqis would greet the American conquerors with throwing flowers on their tanks and that the reconstruction of Iraq would be paid for out of oil revenues. Clearly, the insurgents have gone after three things, the soft targets, anybody that's trying to help the Americans they killed, and they also go after the supply and logistics, but they also go after the oil pipelines. And I believe, I think sabotage, has reduced the output by a third?
Yeah, I mean...
And it was a low output to begin with.
Yeah, this is not going to end. It's not going to end any time soon. It is this war, in my view, was a very poorly planned, and now we can see the military victory was the easy part. A political victory, if you will, is the most difficult and is very unlikely to be achieved. Basically, we have five warring factions in Iraq. It is a very fragmented country. These people have been oppressed for so many years. Think of Yugoslavia under Tito, and when he is gone, guess what happened? We have civil war and atrocities left and right. The same situation in Iraq, and a lot of people had been warning the administration, you go slow, you plan, you do all the... Removing Saddam was a magnificent thing. This is one of the best things that this administration has ever done. But unfortunately, we removed the cancer, but it spread in other parts of the body. So the operation itself was a success, but the patient is not likely to survive the successful operation.
And just then in closing, given that, Fadelgate, that China is coming on more and more demand, and India as well, just foregoing the possibility of a major interruption from a blow up in the Middle East, where would you put oil prices exactly a year from now in March of 2006?
See, the listener must have, the American public has to realize that oil prices today, adjusted for inflation, are still lower than they were in 1981. Adjusted for inflation, the $38 oil in 1981 would have translated into $84 today. So we are far cry from $80. So, we have been consuming oil at incredible speed. We are expanding the size of our homes. We are putting all gadgets we can think of that can, we are paying no attention whatsoever to pollution or environment and everything else. People love their SUVs. We want them bigger and faster and more powerful. So therefore, there's the price that we have to pay. And, in a way, the administration is telling us oil prices are continue to go up, and we better get used to it. And again, this is a commodity at the end of the day will be basically dictated by supply and demand, although it's a little different in a way because we have the politics and, the other things that go with it. But oil prices will continue to move higher unless we have a real energy policy that will dampen demand growth in this country.
Well, it'd have to be bigger than an energy policy. It'd have to do with the kind of cars we buy, the kind of insulation we have, incentives of all kinds.
Well, absolutely.
You know, and it's
absolutely.
just none of that appears to be on the.
No, this is a back burner, at best.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us and giving us filling us in on the economics of oil. And of course, that we have to leave that with saying that we wouldn't have these problems with the environment and geopolitics if we weren't quite so addicted to this drug.
That's correct.
Thank you for joining us, Fidel Gait.
You're very welcome.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Fidel Gait, who's a Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Carol Cuth, the assistant producer,